Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and I'm sitting across from cultural anthropologist Sasha Jenkins. I guess I know you best from Mass Appeal magazine.
That's impressive.
Why is that impressive?
You're on the streets. I mean, Mass Appeal isn't the most mainstream publication.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there are a handful of magazines that do a really good job of covering what Black culture is. Not, I was going to say hip-hop culture, but it's not just that. It's the way hip-hop intersects with R&B, intersects with punk, intersects with metal, all that stuff. And so much of what you do as a thinker and a journalist has been about really influence and confluence. And so you made a documentary about the way, I guess you can say, hip-hop culture has affected fashion, but I have to think of it as being more about the way Black culture has affected style. And the documentary is Fresh Dress. First of all, thanks so much for doing the show, Sasha.
Thank you for having me.
But it really is about that, isn't it? It's about, I mean, so much of what you think is what the way Black culture impacts the mainstream, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in regards to the film itself, going off of what you just said, I think that fashion in the inner city, you know, runway fashion is about privilege. Fashion in the inner city is about reacting to environment and about survival. And that's what hip-hop, quote-unquote hip-hop fashion has been. But before there was hip-hop, you had chitlins. You know, what are chitlins? Chitlins is the stuff that nobody wanted. We reimagined it. We remixed it. And that's what hip-hop is. Hip-hop is not seeing yourself in the mainstream, but seeing things in the mainstream that you enjoy, and then you sample all these different things to create something wholly new. And hip-hop is the spice on top. It's the icing. It's the attitude. So hip-hop samples all kinds of music, but the attitude is the voice.
But it's also about really subtle things, too. And so much of this is, so much of Black culture and hip-hop is really this, is about shoes.
Okay. This is coming from a man who's currently wearing some really nice Stan Smiths.
It's radio. It doesn't matter to anybody what I'm wearing right now. But that idea, it even goes back to the chitlin. And the chitlin circle, these things you're talking about, the idea of the fact that one of the first things that you can make an impression with is a pair of shoes. And what hip-hop culture did was it was the breakaway from, what should you say, the Black pop mainstream, the R&B, sort of the dress-up thing. And it was sneakers, because that was considered to be sort of like kid culture or not serious culture. And hip-hop said, no, it is that, didn't it?
Yeah, and you know, then there's this, the street vernacular, the term sneaker pimp. You know, kids today think sneaker pimp means you're someone who collects sneakers and has lots of them. But in the pimp game, if you were a sneaker pimp, it meant you weren't serious. You were a chump.
You're
wearing
kid.
Sneakers.
You were
we
punk.
Can't take
yes.
you seriously. And so Run DMC, you know, early hip-hop, you know, Bambaataa and Cold Crush and all these guys, either they went to one extreme, which was looking at rock and roll or Parliament Funkadelic and sort of modeled themselves after that look, saying, hey, we're stars too. We can be outlandish and crazy. Or, you know, Cold Crush, these guys went for Armani's, you know, they went for suits. Like, hey, look, you're spending good money on us. We've got money. We look good. You're paying to see celebrities. But when Run DMC came along, they said, hey, we're going to dress like we do in the hood. We're going to dress like the dopest drug dealer around the way. And the stuff that the dopest drug dealer around the way wore in 1984, it might have been a little bit more expensive, but it wasn't like so expensive you couldn't pronounce it. You could get your dough up to get a nice pair of shell-toe Adidas. So when Run DMC came along with that look, and the fact that they musically were so open, you know, they employed rock and roll. This is when hip-hop was just breaking into the mainstream. The fact that they embraced rock and roll and did stuff with Aerosmith, et cetera, and the fact that the way they dressed wasn't so out of reach, it helped spread hip-hop in ways that made people understand that hip-hop was basically created by kids in parks and kids who went to parties. And it was a reflection of how those kids dressed and how they thought.
But it's that sort of thing that what the movie really gets to, this thing that hip-hop was a very scary thing. The idea of showing up somewhere in a jean suit and a pair of Adidas made you a scary guy, or the tougher-than-leather period where you wore, like, brand-new leather. So much of that early hip-hop stuff was like everything had to be new. and to Channing Tatum being a part of Sean John Cho, or for me, the real moment of crossover finally is that not just Jay-Z dropping Tom Ford, but when you have French street culture adopting hip hop, when you have Pigalle and Ricardo Tisci, who you have in the film, when that happens, then that's when we know it's not just, it really is a worldwide phenomenon, isn't it?
Well, that's, you know, it's like with everything black, and I don't want to just say hip hop is just black, but Latinos as well, you know, brown people, black and brown people. In America, things initially are very scary, right? Rock and roll, which essentially the word itself means the F word in black slang. You know, it was very scary. Then Elvis did it. It was still scary and taboo. And then all of a sudden, rock and roll becomes this white phenomenon. And so then it becomes an American music, right? And something that we export. And the same thing has happened with hip hop. Hip hop was very scary. You know, what are these people doing? What are they saying? We can't relate to it. It's gangster rap. It's this, that, and the third. And now that hip hop has become American music, you know, I tell the story all the time, being the creative director at Mass Appeal and working with kids easily half my age, some of them, you know, Caucasian. What kind of music did you come up on? Do you like Led Zeppelin? Because, you know, a brother like me likes some Led Zeppelin. No, I've heard of them. Like, you've heard of them. You're white and you don't know Led Zeppelin? No, my mom bought me, like, my first cassette was DMX. You know, I grew up on hip hop, man, you know? And so once hip hop becomes the fabric of America, pun intended, it turns into something that's okay. And then it spreads around the world as this thing that Americans create.
It's the treatment. We're talking about another F word here, fashion, with Sasha Jenkins, the director of the new documentary, Fresh Dressed. Talk about the genesis of the film for me, because I've got to think on some level you've been sort of compiling information about this for years. And again, I don't think of you as being somebody who's solely about hip hop. For me, it's always been, that's why I use the phrase cultural anthropologist, because all these ways in which the culture intersects with other parts of the culture has been an interest for you.
Well, a lot of it has been a direct relation to my life. Hip-hop is a part of my DNA. Like, I had a screening in Silver Spring, Maryland yesterday. I lived there until I was about 7 years old, and then I moved to Astoria, Queens. And I went outside, and people had magic markers and spray paint, and there was music being played in the park. And I was like, what the hell is this? And I didn't know it then, but what it was, it became a part of my DNA. You know, before there were recorded music or clothing brands that catered to people in the hip-hop set, we were literally doing it in the park. So I grew up as a graffiti artist. You know, I rode on trains. I wasn't the most famous graffiti artist.
But you got your start really detailing graffiti culture in print.
Yeah, I published a zine when I was a kid, and that led to me publishing a hip-hop newspaper, which led to me publishing a hip-hop magazine, which led to me writing for Vibe and being the music editor, which led to me writing books, which led to me producing television. So
I really know you from Ego Trip. That's really where
I started Ego Trip.
Yeah, okay.
Co-founded it. So everything that I've done has been a direct relation to my real life. Like today I'm in a punk band. You know, I play, you know, really aggressive music to a largely white audience. You know, I was in a band with Daryl Jennifer of the Bad Brains, okay.
The original DC black punk band.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, and the most, maybe one of the most influential punk bands of all time, by the way.
100%. And the fact that I had the honor and privilege to be in a band with Daryl has been amazing. And so throughout my life, you know, Henry Chalfon, who did the book Subway Art, you know, I remember being in the same crappy junior high that Nas dropped out of, and I probably spent too much time there, really looking at a book called Subway Art. And years later, Henry Chalfon, who was one of the folks behind that book, would become a mentor and a friend. And he and I recently did a book about subway graffiti. So going back to your initial question, all of these sort of things that were a part of my early DNA, if I become really fascinated by something, I find ways to become directly involved with it. And through that direct involvement, I believe the things that I'm able to create give a more detailed perspective on what these movements and things, people, places, and things are.
Because I guess I just find myself thinking, too, like in the movie, it was interesting, first of all, to see a documentary about fashion at Sundance in the first place, but also really to see a movie that made people think about, oh, because so much of the things that the movie details are things that were both big but really subtle. Mm-hmm. And just that kind of that initial impact is sort of like almost like a meteor hitting the planet, and then it changes the ecosystem. And that, to me, is what this film feels like.
Well, thank you. I mean, for me, the film came about because I realized, as someone who'd been writing about hip-hop and the culture for so long, one of the most important facets is fashion, how you dressed. I mean, you could be the best rapper of all time, but if you had whack style in terms of how you dressed, you would never, ever get respect. And so thinking about that and thinking about growing up in Astoria, Queens, and remembering Easter and remembering that—
Basically, Queens being the epicenter of hip-hop.
Well, you know, people in the Bronx will disagree, and I have to give it up to Uptown. You guys get credit for creating it, but I think Queens, if you look at our history and everyone who's come out of Queens, we run hip-hop. Sorry.
But the
Bronx created it.
You don't look sorry.
No. Bronx created it. Uptown, thank you. But between Russell Simmons and all the artists that have come out of there and our influence, remembering Easter and remembering the Easter break in the hood, which was you have this time off, and when you came back to school, if you didn't have fresh gear, you would be ridiculed. And I remember so many kids whose parents who could not afford to buy them the fresh new gear, these kids that I grew up with sold crack and could make $1,000, $1,200 a day selling crack, and you can buy your whole building a pair of Adidas if you wanted to. And so I wanted the film to get into the creativity, this sort of the Chitlins, working with what we had. You know, sneakers were for athletes, you know. It wasn't about lifestyle. We created that.
That idea of that kind of ruthlessness of black culture is something you've been detailing a little bit too for a long time, and also how quickly these transitions occur. In visual terms in the film, you use a lot of hip-hop type of graphics, and the graphics shift from year to year, really, as you're depicting this. So again, all these things that you are and these things that you've been following and writing about, it seems like fashion was kind of the ideal way to use this kind of this sociological study.
Yeah, because I started as early as slavery in the film, you know, with the notion of Sunday best. And you ask anyone, what does Sunday best mean? And they'll tell you it means you look nice for church, which is halfway right. But most people don't know that it means that there was a time during slavery where it was mandated that slave owners had to buy their slaves one nice outfit so they can go to church to worship a completely foreign god and dress a completely foreign way. So I wanted the film to sort of look at how fashion was connected to how society was moving and how black people were moving along with society as it moved. And so it goes from slavery to the South Bronx in the 70s, which looked like World War II Poland, right? The kids there, who were their idols? Who did they look up to? They wanted to be like the Hell's Angels. Well, why is that? Look at their environment. You know, rough, rugged, and raw.
Or even if we go to the West Coast, sorry about that, Hollis and Bronx, but the NWA, that was all prison wear. Those big jackets and jeans they wore, that was the stuff you wore. Again, it's the same sort of thing. It's basically sort of saying, and this that shift that you talk about in the film and that happened in the late 70s, early 80s, that, you know, we're not ever going to be part of mainstream society. So we're going to basically celebrate the Chitlins again, you know, prison wear, this gangster wear, this stuff that you can't ever wear into a school or job interview and be taken seriously with.
So then what does that say? And I'm not saying there's nothing cool about wearing that stuff. People enjoy it. There's a whole aesthetic to it. But then what does it really say when you're wearing stuff that's branded for prisoners? Again, there's a guy in my film named Mayer who he can wear a brand new pair of sneakers every day for 7 years. He tells the story of, you know, his mom buying these sneakers called the Mark 5, and he was all excited because his name is Mark. And so he walks back to the block and he thinks he's the man and he gets laughed off the block. Ha, ha, ha. Those sneakers are cheap. You're a bum. You're a loser. And he said, yo, you know what? I'm never going to get laughed at again. And here he is, a man in his 40s. Who has one of the biggest, most valuable sneaker collections in the world. But where did that come from? It came from people in his own community laughing at him because he couldn't afford to have the nice sneakers, or his mom didn't think to buy them, or maybe his mom couldn't afford to buy them. And so that mentality, that feeling of being ostracized still lingers with him as a grown man.
And on that really interesting note, we're going to take a break. I'm talking with the director of the new film, Fresh Dress, Sasha Jenkins. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
It's Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking style, fashion, and its sociological questions that the film, the great new film, Fresh Dress, brings up. Its director of the documentary, Sasha Jenkins, is sitting across from me. I guess what I found myself thinking about, too, in watching the film was seeing it at Sundance with an audience that I heard a lot of kind of, that kind of... You must have been really thrilled at the idea of being able to expose this to an audience, probably at least a third composed of people who grew up in hip-hop, and a lot of them being white kids who just hadn't really asked themselves those questions, but also a lot of people who go to documentaries at Sundance who hadn't thought about the social implications of really black disenfranchisement, going to the church being a place where, as we know, where people of color got together to congregate and build their social traditions because they couldn't meet anywhere else, or they'd be accused of trying to foment a riot. In fact, a school of thought that still exists to this very day. And seeing people who took documentary seriously at that screening with the, where I met you was like, that must have been really a great experience for you.
Yeah. I mean, sadly, you know, the church is still a place where many of us go and we can't find peace there, you know.
I was just thinking about that as I was saying that.
South Carolina. Yeah. A woman came up to me after the film and she said, you know what? I'm a 72-year-old white woman. And she looked down at what she was wearing and she said, you know, I'm not very fresh. And then she said, you know what? I never thought of this. You know, I always just put clothes on. I never thought about what it meant, what I wore. I never thought about that. And she was like, that was thoroughly fascinating. And I feel like I learned something. Thank you so much. So for me to first of all, be at Sundance was unbelievable. And second of all, to connect, it was amazing because they have these screenings away from the industry, like out in Salt Lake for the people of Salt Lake. And those screenings were really fascinating because folks just never knew the science, you know, or the sociology that went into the way folks dressed. And to create something, you know, this film was financed, CNN Films. They financed this. And so CNN is looking to connect with a younger audience. And obviously, it's not a bad thing to connect with more folks of color. But it's great to be able to have produced something that can live on a CNN and educate people and also entertain people, but also be true to the culture, to the core of where it comes from. And that, for me, is what's most important in terms of being, you know, a director of color and having the opportunity to tell these stories. You know, I'm not saying that you have to be black or Latino to tell these stories, but I'm saying that we need more opportunities for folks like me to tell these stories.
I guess so. As we talk about this, I wonder what your pitch to CNN was, how you had how the conversation about Fresh Dressed got started.
Well, initially, a gentleman named Sean Carter was going to be an executive producer on the film. And so when I was pitching it to my agent...
happened to him? Who knows whatever happened to him?
What do you mean?
That's Sean Carter.
Oh, yeah, you know, who knows where he's wound up, what he wound up getting into. He didn't get into my film. But so I told my agent, hey, listen, you know, I have this idea. He's like, well, who's attached? I was like, well, Sean, Jay-Z, can you get him on tape? So, you know, it's another one of these things. Reached out to his people on a Tuesday. They said, can you fly to England tomorrow? Flew to England the next day. Got a really great interview with him where we talked about some really heavy things. Had that on tape. So I'm very lucky that Mr. Sean Carter said, I think this is a great idea. Here are my thoughts. And so once I had that really amazing interview, my agent was able to go to work and set up some meetings, and I met a gentleman named Vinny Malhotra at CNN Films, who's an Indian brother from New Jersey who liked Brand Nubian. And so we bonded on hip-hop, and he saw the value of what it was that I was doing, and here we are.
It's The Treatment. My head is spinning because the idea of Brand Nubian being discussed in the halls of CNN is a really, really trippy idea. I'm talking to the director of the new film, Fresh Dressed, Sasha Jenkins. One of the things that fascinates me about this is seeing there's so many people, like you getting a chance to show the public Andre Leon Talley, who we should say was Anna Wintour's muse, who was the man who really, as much as anybody, was responsible for Vogue magazine. Talk about getting him, because he's a pretty elusive subject, too.
My friend and associate producer, Philip Leeds, you know, he's worked with Pharrell closely for many years. And so he had a great relationship with Andre because Andre has a great relationship with Pharrell. And so it wasn't the easiest thing, but he showed up and he was looking around like, hey, where's Pharrell? What's going on? So I don't know what Philip told him, but I'm very grateful for whatever moves he pulled as the associate producer. But he gave an amazing interview with a cold and had some really great insights, you know, talked about Little Richard and the church and very important core things that speak to the African-American experience and connected to, you know, the mainstream popular culture and runways, et cetera.
Because one of the things that people will get a chance to see in this and a way that they hadn't thought about before is there's so much Black influence. The fascinating thing is that given that there really haven't maybe been only a handful of important Black designers, still the Black influence is really potent. And the idea of people such as Kanye or Pharrell or Andre Leon Talley, it's not all hip-hop. Again, that's why I don't want to just try to be reductive about this and say it's a film about hip-hop culture, because it's really, to me, first and foremost, a film about Black culture.
For sure. But even more interestingly, or not more interestingly, but simultaneously, you learn more about the influence of Latinos, which they are often overlooked. And at every step of the way, if you really pay attention to the film, whether it's Lorraine, who is a member of the Savage Skulls, these are the folks who created hip-hop, you know, these gangs, the energy that they had. Or you flash forward to Thurston Howell III, who is in a gang called the Lowlifes. Low is short for Polo. And he tells the story of how, you know, he had no furniture in his house in the projects, but he had Polo, you know? But really the power is in what we see in these brands and what we apply to it and what we say is cool and the energy of hip hop. That's what makes Polo in our world cool. It's not just the fact that Ralph makes great clothing. It's the fact that these powerful minds in hip hop have assigned or ascribed this energy to these garments.
As you talk about that, I think about two of the most interesting things about fashion over the last 30 years, that it was really people of color making Timberland a big deal. And also people of color really, there wouldn't be a Tommy Hilfiger if it weren't for people of color. I mean, it was really people of color who rescued and embraced that brand, wasn't it?
Well, and what's interesting about that is, you know, a couple of folks have asked, well, you know, film's great, but, you know, you didn't have Ralph or Tommy. You know, how come you didn't talk to them? Well, they didn't want to talk to me. And on one hand, you look at Ralph. He's from the Bronx. Lifshitz is his last name. The Lowlife gang, they worship this guy. They see his life story as hip hop. So on one hand, he doesn't have to say anything. On the other hand, I think it would be nice if folks acknowledged, hey, listen, I know I created this box. I know you might not feel like it's for you. It might not even be for you. But I appreciate the fact that you've come here. I appreciate the fact that you've supported me. I appreciate that, yeah, you might have, some of you guys might have stolen stuff, but that's overshadowed by all the folks in your world who came in and spent great money on my brand and helped me grow. So thank you.
But those are certainly Ralph. And it's funny you talk about that. I mean, there's also a guy who got his start working on the Great Gatsby, the movie. So, and his son ended up doing the movie G, which was a hip-hop version of Gatsby. So all these collisions that he didn't acknowledge, that fascinates me. Because as we were talking about, it just occurred to me, I was thinking about Timberland, who basically a brand that ended up attacking its Black customer base. And then Tommy Hilfiger, who was for a long time thought was being kind of like an imitation Ralph brand until hip-hop culture really elevated that. And so much of this to me is this thing you were talking about, for cultures of color that are disenfranchised, taking what has been discarded and just owning it so enthusiastically that it becomes defined in a very different way.
Yeah. But then simultaneously, there was this period where you had all these rappers who launched their own brands. They said, hey, no one's making stuff for us. Why don't we do our own thing? And so Sean John and Rock Aware and Echo and this whole world of quote-unquote streetwear or urban wear appeared, and a lot of money was made for a long time. And people of color were proud to wear FUBU in these brands. Like, hey, finally one of us is making it. We're doing it. Awesome. This feels great. And then it gets to this place where all of a sudden everything with us is so disposable. You know, we're so quick to be in and out with the trends. Like, we make these things and then, I don't know, we have ADD or something, but we're so quick to dismiss ourselves. You know, so at one point, FUBU was great. Next moment, that's played out. I don't want to wear that stuff. I want to wear the stuff I can't pronounce. Well, why? Well, because, you know, Jigga's wearing that. But I think people realize in the end, that's why these collaborations are really popular now between rappers and bigger brands. If we own nothing, the one thing we do own is this attitude, this energy, and this spirit.
Well, see, that's why I was bringing that up, because that paucity, given the enormity of the impact that people of color have had on style, I'm not going to say fashion, because I think it's bigger than that. The size of that impact as compared to still the lack of ownership, then that still speaks to an enormous, I keep using this word, but a problem in Black culture, that idea of ownership of ideal, but not of physical property.
We've been bred to be consumers. And I don't think that's just Black people. I think there are plenty of poor white Americans.
But it gets back to the whole idea for a long time, people of color. I mean, there's a covenant in the laws of the state of California until the mid-'80s that Black people can own houses. So much of that becomes, if you can't have anything else, then your property and your art is yourself. And that's the explicit message in Fresh Dressed.
Well, if you were to just put Black people in a pot and try to distill what it was that America wanted from us, that's what they would want. They would want our creativity. But there was a time in this garmento world where hip-hop reigned supreme and made lots of money, and I wanted the film to explore that and celebrate that.
And what that film, that section of film that you're talking about too, what I thought was, oh, that's what happened, because so much of Black culture, again, this is thing that Ego Trip used to cover a lot and Mass Appeal still does, that ruthlessness about how if something is old, then it's old, and you just discard it. I mean, you don't ever go back to it until, you know, then you have a line like this fashion collective like Black Etiquette that does go back to 90s stuff, but it becomes ironic. But once it's done, it's done. If you're seen wearing last year's Stan Smith or Shell Toes, people just, oh, y'all must be poor. That's so sad. You still wearing that stuff? I mean, that idea of rootlessness finally is at the heart of the film. To me.
Yeah, I mean, I think white folks who are doing well, how they dress, I'm sure it's a part of their psyche, but it doesn't own them. It doesn't define them. Where what we dress, forget about trying to get a job, you know, how that may or may not define us, but internally within our own world, how we dress defines us on so many different levels, and how we have to constantly keep up with the Joneses if you want to play that game. I mean, you look at the dozens, like, you know, we celebrate the dozens. It's an art form, right? It's great. But it's almost like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, where does it come from?
Wow. I guess I know what your next film's going to be about. We're out of time. Sasha, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest is Sasha Jenkins. His new film, which is in the theaters and will be on CNN soon, is the documentary Fresh Dressed. Our recording engineer in New York and NPR in New York is our old friend Manoli Wither. Hi, Manoli. The show will be mixed by Melissa Morton, is edited by my associate producer, Blake Veit. I'm in the back changing my outfit. It's The Treatment.
Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.